I'm Joe Bianca.
I'm Bill Finley.
I'm Jonathan Green.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 10:07, Wednesday, December 9th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And this is episode 66. So two-thirds of the way through this podcast, we'll be two-thirds of the way to 100. And then you really won't be able to get rid of us.
Hi, I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News. I want to congratulate John Green on being elected to the New York Thoroughbred Horsemen's Association Board of Directors. However, I have learned that the person he beat is questioning the ballots. Some came in too late. Stop the steal, John.
You know what, Bill? I can honestly say that was the funniest intro you've done in all 66 shows. That was actually very clever. Very nice. And now I know how Al and Brian feel. I have nothing that can top that. I'm John Green, general manager of DJ Stable, and I'm really looking forward to this show.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. Make note of Keeneland's upcoming sales, the December digital sale, which will be in the Keeneland digital sales ring on Tuesday, December 15th, and the 2021 January Horses of Racing Age sale from January 11th to January 14th. Visit Keeneland.com for more details. And to view the catalogs for both sales online, 1,588 horses have been entered in Keeneland January, 808 broodmare and broodmare prospects, 697 short yearlings, 78 horses of racing age, and 5 stallion or stallion prospects. So a little something for everybody coming up at Keeneland January. All right, so we had some interesting results over the weekend. I think the main one that everyone is going to want to talk about is the Cigar Mile. True Temper, not exactly a household name, but he really actually was pretty impressive in that race. It had a sloppy track, really beautiful scene at Aqueduct with the mud and the purple sky in the background. Sarah Andrew had a great photo of the race in Sunday's TDN. A couple other photographers got some good shots as well. It was beautiful. Beautiful sunset race, but you know, I think the story for me was Kendrick Carmouche and Jack Sisterson. You know, this is not the household name duo that you would expect to win a Cigar Mile, but they've really, I think, earned these kind of accolades, especially Kendrick Carmouche. This was his first career Grade One victory, and this is a guy who, you know, really works hard day in and day out in New York and has held his own. And you know, he stays there in the winter at Aqueduct, and that's not an easy thing to do. You know, even, you know, Arad Ortiz got sick of it after a while. He was winning at like 30-35% at Aqueduct in the winter, and eventually he was like, screw it, I got to get some warm weather. So definitely not an easy thing to do, but he's done it every single winter. He's earned his way to this spot, and I love watching him ride just because he's an aggressive rider. He's not a guy who's going to take back and strangle horses back and you know, let somebody else go take an easy lead. So I think he's what horse racing should be in terms of, you know, horsemanship on the back of a horse. He does everything right. He makes the most of his opportunities. And this was long overdue. I was actually surprised to hear that it was his first Grade One win, because he's ridden some big horses before, like Pure Sensation. But so hats off to him, and as well Jack Sisterson, who's an up and coming trainer. We had him on the show. Great guy. He got his first Grade One win with Vexatious against Midnight Bizou in the summer. Now he picks up another one with True Timber, another horse that he's improved off of Kieran McLaughlin, which is not an easy thing to do. And he's done it. He did the same thing with Vexatious off of Neil Howard. Or Neil Drysdale. And he deserves a lot of credit as well. There's going to be a bunch more Grade One wins for Jack Sisterson. So hat tip to both of them. There were some comments from the trainer of the beaten favorite that we're going to get to in a little bit that were interesting, but I just wanted to get some first blush responses from you guys.
Yeah, Joe, there are plenty of races to talk about, but let's just stick to the Cigar right now. And, you know, when this part of the show, we want to talk about the highlights of the weekend. You know, yes, Kendrick Carmouche is a nice story. Seems like a really good guy, tries hard, happy for him. But we've got to be honest a little bit. I think it's safe to say this race was a major disappointment. And, you know, let's look, the facts are the facts on True Timber. He had lost 13 straight races coming into the Cigar Mile and hadn't won since September 16th of 2018, allowance race at Belmont. He had never before won a stakes race. So, I mean, he took advantage of the situation. He got the job done. There were also 3 scratches in the race, which reduced the field. But, you know, it was not a race in hindsight that you know, to get too excited about really anybody. And it wasn't just that True Timber, you know, after a couple years where he struggled to find the winner's circle won, but I think the disappointment obviously was performer. And I know we're going to talk about the mudslinging between Chad Brown and Chuck McGahee a little bit later. But, you know, here's a horse you could look at him and say, you know, he really might have a bright future. This is somebody we're going to get excited about in 2021. He was a bad third. Now, was it because of the conditions, you know, really muddy, crummy day from that aspect? Very well could have been. You will give him another shot, but certainly he took a step in the wrong direction. I think you can say the same for King Guillermo. You know, he was the unknown. He had raced so few times, but, you know, he had showed a lot of promise as a three-year-old. He hadn't raced since the Arkansas Derby, and he was a bad fourth. So, you know, this is a race that I think you can look back and just say, okay, let's move on to the next one. Good for Kendrick Carmouche, but, you know, hard to really get excited about anything that happened on the racetrack.
Usually I'm the one that's, you know, screaming from the rooftops, let's downgrade this race, let's downgrade this race. But no, Bill, I agree with you. With the scratches, I mean, before the scratches, you could say it was, you know, a legitimate field. With the scratches and with the track conditions, it definitely was watered down, no pun intended, where we'll look back on this Cigar Mile and say, yeah, it was a grade one, but. That being said, True Timber still won by 5+ lengths. You know, and looked impressive doing it. There were some other interesting, you know, thoughts about a couple other horses. King Guillermo, who, again, he ran like a horse who hadn't run in over half a year. And that's what horses do when you give them time off like that because of injury and illness. Sometimes it takes them a little while to kind of get back to that level, and to throw them right back into a grade one, albeit a watered down one, but still a grade one, is still asking a lot. So the horse went out on top and then faded, which is not unusual for, you know, for a horse coming off a layoff. The other head scratcher for me is Mr. Buff. I mean, here's a horse that just kills. He's a crusher against New York breds. And it's almost like he knows when he's not running against New York breds. I don't think he's hit the board in any of the graded stake races that he's run in New York, outside of, you know, when he runs in the Haynesfield and the Alex Robb and some of the other New York breds. So is he a legitimate horse? Yeah, the horse made $1.2 million in his career. But if he wasn't a New York bred, maybe he wouldn't be, you know, at this kind of caliber, because he's certainly shown that every time he steps up to a grade three or grade two or grade one, he, at least recently, he hasn't, you know, answered the bell. And last but not least, and Bill, I think you'll appreciate this sentiment as well, old dudes rule. Old dudes rule. You got the winner by Mineshaft, who's 20 years old. You got, you know, the horse that ran second, City Zip, who, you know, passed away, but he would have been 21 this year. And Spitestown, you know, the sire of Performer, who was also 21 years old. So, you know, it's great that when we talk about Nyquist and Frosted and Not This Time and all these really great up-and-coming, Leoban, all these great up-and-coming sires. But, man, I love it when the old dudes, you know, get their horses in the winner's circle, especially in grade one. So congratulations to Mineshaft, Spitestown, and RIP City Zip.
Yeah, I was a big fan. I was a big fan of Mineshaft, so I'm always happy to see him do well. He was coming on right when I was first starting to follow racing. I saw him win the Suburban and a couple other big races in New York. So he was one of the horses that got me hooked on racing. But just to follow up on a couple of you guys' points, True Timber is so interesting because it seems like they should just run him in the Cigar Mile. Just don't run him in any other races, because if you look back in 2018, he was second at 31-1 at beating 3/4 of a length. Then last year he was third to Maximum Security with a wide trip at 32-1. And this year he breaks through in a big way. So I don't know what it is about Aqueduct or that race, but he always seems to show up. But, you know, tip of the cap to you if you were able to sniff out that True Timber Snapper Sinclair Exacta. That was a tough one to have. But I agree that, you know, Performer and King Guillermo, the race was more about their disappointments and their kind of no-shows. King Guillermo, at least you could have the excuse that the pace was fast, but he packed it in early. He packed it in before Mr. Buff did. And, you know, it's just, I think that there are questions that remain about how good he actually is. He had that big win in the Tampa Bay Derby going turf to dirt. Ran okay in the Arkansas Derby. Didn't run great. Ran okay. Was never really threatening Nadal. And then obviously the long layoff threw a wrench into things. So, you know, you can give him another shot, but I think there's a question mark about how good he really is. And Performer got a perfect setup. You know, I don't buy the idea. I mean, maybe he hated the track, but I just think that's always an easy excuse. for a horse that didn't show up. And for him to not even get second in that race, I thought was extremely disappointing for a horse that I think a lot of people had, including myself included, had high expectations, not just for this race, but going forward. And maybe he will still turn into that miler monster. He certainly wouldn't write him off just yet, but definitely not a good performance by him. I just wanted to touch on some of the other races from the weekend. And we in the Remsen, we had Brooklyn Strong, who's a son of Wicked Strong, who was only a $5,000 OBS spring purchase. Bill had a great story this week in the TDN with the owner and the trainer of Brooklyn Strong. The owner is Mark Schwartz. The trainer is Danny Velasquez. Danny Velasquez actually also won the New York Stallion Series stake on Sunday at Aqueduct with Lau Van on a Prayer, who seems to be an okay 2-year-old filly. But you know, this is the kind of story that you like in racing, because it proves that the small guy can compete with the big guy. And he got a 93 buyer. Like, it's not, you know, the Philly race was much slower. Malathat, who visually was pretty impressive because she seemed so out of it, only got a 76. And Brooklyn Strong really had to run down that Sug horse. So I think even though he's modestly bred, even though he didn't cost that much, I think he's an interesting horse going forward. You got to think he's already proven that he's good around two turns. So that's a big advantage to have that kind of foundation early in your 2-year-old season, as far as I'm concerned. So that's a performance that I think we might be looking back on and think, well, this is where this horse really broke out. But obviously a lot still to be determined. I just wanted to mention the Claiming Crown real quick, because there were a couple horses in there who I think are going to be big time graded stakes horses. It was a terrific card on Saturday at Gulfstream. They broke the record for Claiming Crown handle. I think it was 14.5 million was handled on that card, 11 races. So shout out to everybody at Gulfstream, everybody who continues to support the Claiming Crown, because I was ribbing it a little bit last week that we didn't want to talk about it, but it is a great event. And it really does showcase horses who fill the races on a day-to-day basis in racing. And we appreciate that. But the two horses that I think are standouts in terms of, you know, competing in open company going forward are Jesus's Team, who won the Claiming Crown Jewel. Now, he had to work hard for it. He was a 1-5 favorite, and he only won by a half length or a neck. But he got a 97 buyer. He's going to the Pegasus next. He was second in the was he second or third in the Preakness? Third, right? Because yeah, Authentic and Swiss Skydiver. So he was third in the Preakness at a big price. And then the other one is Faya, who won the Claiming Crown Canterbury Dash, going 5 furlongs on the turf. This was a horse who was bought at the Wanamaker's online sale. He cost a bunch of money there. And he is fast. He is real fast. If you watch his races, he just bowls out of there and nobody can run with him, at least yet. He drew the rail in that race on Saturday and really had to, he didn't actually even have to be used. He kind of just, Luis Saez kind of chirped at him once and he went out to the front and just never looked back. He's a horse that I think could be really interesting, maybe even going overseas to Royal Ascot for a 5-furlong race, or, you know, dare I say the Alquo sprint or something. He's not at that level yet, but I think that's the kind of talent that he has. And also shout out to Luis Saez for winning 6 races on the Claiming Crown card. He had a lot of live mounts, didn't really win with any big prices, but still to win 6 races on any card, you know, much less one that had as much stakes action as that one did, is an accomplishment. So anything else from the weekend that you guys wanted to touch on?
Yeah, since you touched on the Claiming Crown and the 2-year-old races at Aqueduct, how about the Starlet, the other grade one of the weekend? And, you know, Joe, you hinted before. Yeah, I mean, Los Alamitos really tries hard, but, you know, and I think they've been treated unfairly by getting so few dates and everything. But these 2-year-old races just aren't working for them. And, you know, they downgraded the male race, but not the Starlet. So the Los Alamitos Futurity is coming up as a grade two, which Bob Baffert has won 47 times. Now you have the Starlet. Again, it's all Baffert all the time. He's 1-2, but what do you, Baffert wins with the 17-1 shot in Varda. So you look at the race coming in, there's really two horses that you're interested in. Princess Noor, we talk so much about coming into the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Filly, where she was a little bit disappointing, but still a 2-time grade one winner. And then Astute, who's a horse that looks like, wow, you know, this really could be an up-and-coming horse. You know, very well bred, had been impressive coming into the race, trained by Mandela. So what do you get? Princess Noor was pulled up, injured, and retired. And of the 4 horses left in the race, Astute ran last. So, you know, kind of like with the cigar, you look back on it, you know, oh boy, you know, there's really, it was more negative than positive. The positive was, okay, you know, Baffert wins. He's 1-2 with two long shots, but they're not horses you're going to get really excited about. And the horses you were excited about didn't perform well. So maybe I'm taking the mantle of John Green of poo-pooing everything or downgrading everything, make it a grade four, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, again, this was another race that in hindsight, geez, you know, not a lot of good things to say about it.
Bill, you've never looked more handsome nor sound more intelligent than right now, I have to say. But no, you're 100% right. You know, you look at the Starlet and you say, it was unfortunate about Princess Noor, and you know, she does have two grade ones under her belt, so she will be a great, you know, broodmare candidate, and we wish her nothing the best. But the winner of the race, Varda, you know, who again is the winner, so we can't take that away from her, ran a 68 buyer, which was just kind of meh. So, you know, what's that?
Kind of.
Well, I'm being kind. I'm trying to turn over a new leaf. I'm being the kind of John Green.
You have to balance it out with Bill being the crap.
Bill taking over my role of being the jerk. Yeah, exactly. So that was that. A couple other races I did want to mention. The Remsen, which was a grade two over the weekend. You know, Brooklyn Strong was the story. I think it's awesome. Awesome that a $5,000 two-year-old purchase, you know, can come in and not only win a couple of New York bred stake races, but then go on a bigger stage and get points for the Kentucky Derby. So, you know, very excited to see a horse like that continue to move forward. And the horse that ran second, 10 for 10, is a Frosted. And we've talked about Frosted and you know, where that horse, that son of Tappet, looks like he's you know, cresting as far as a freshman sire. And this horse should get better as they get older. So that was kind of a fun race to watch. The Gopher Wand, you know, had a good group of older mares in it, the grade three. And we talked before about, you know, the rider winning his first grade one Carmouche. How about Horacio De Paz winning his first graded stake race with Sharp Star for Barry Schwartz? So shout out to the De Paz team. He doesn't have a lot of horses, but, you know, you look at the way the horses come in the paddock and you look at his win percentage, and the guy knows what he's doing. So I was pleased to see that he won his first graded stake race of his young training career. And then the Damoiselle, you know, we kind of glossed over it, but how about Daughters of Curlin finishing first and second, hitting the exacta, the Curlin exacta in the Damoiselle?
I believe they were 1-2-3, weren't they?
Yeah. Yep. First, second,
Curlin
and third.
Trifecta. Very good. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. First, second, and third. I missed that Malibu Curl, you know, ran third in that race. I was so focused on the fact that the first two horses were up, you know, on the rest of the field. But, you know, again, an older sire, 17 years old, and just pumping out, you know, more candidates for, you know, for Derby and Oaks races. So I was really pleased to, you know, in that sense that some of these old dogs, you know, still have some fight and still have some horses in the races. But I thought it was overall, it was a good, solid, you know, racing weekend between the Claiming Crown in Florida and some of the bigger races here on the East Coast.
Yeah, now it's going to be a little bit of a wasteland until the Malibu, and then after that as well. But just to follow up on a couple of your points, the Gopher Wand had a really nice, fun stretch battle between the pace setter in there and Sharp Star. And it's going to be interesting to see what Horacio De Paz does going forward, because Sagamore is getting out of the game. And that was his main client, was the Sagamore horses after Stan Huff retired. Now Stan Huff is back. But I wonder if John Green is going to send Horacio a couple more horses, since he talks them up on the podcast. Brooklyn Strong, I love horses that develop the way he's developing. Like, he's debuted for a $40,000 tag at Delaware, won by three lengths, got a 53 buyer. They ran him in the Bertram Bongard, which is a New York bred stake at Belmont, got a 62 buyer, ran third. Ran him in the Sleepy Hollow, another New York bred stake at Belmont, won by 2.25 lengths, got a 77 buyer. So 53, 62, 77, got a 93 on Saturday. And you look at the field and you think, well, that figure's a little phony. The horses hadn't really run above an 80, but the first two finishers were almost 9 lengths clear of third. And then the third horse was 8.25 clear of fourth. So I think, you know, in this scenario, it's just that the top two horses ran career tops. And I love watching that progression from a horse like Brooklyn Strong. And then about the Starlet, I mean, yeah, there's no reason for the Starlet to continue to be a grade one. I agree with Bill that you know, Los Alamitos kind of gets a raw deal on the California calendar. But nevertheless, this is a race that I think has not been grade one quality since it left Hollywood Park. Same with the Futurity. I mean, these were big time races on the calendar when they were at Hollywood, and they're afterthoughts now. And Princess Nora did get pulled up right after she took the lead, basically, in that race. But thankfully she's all right. She was retired on Sunday with a soft tissue injury. So she'll go to the breeding shed. And that part is kind of unfortunate because she was such an unknown in that she had these two grade one wins, these blowout wins, but she just had not run that fast race yet. And she disappointed a little bit as the favorite in the juvenile fillies. And it was going to be interesting to see if she would have been able to build on that 2-year-old filly campaign as a 3-year-old and start running those top figures and become a top level grade one horse. I mean, fillies tend to develop a little bit more than the boys do over time. So unfortunately that we won't get to see her develop, but we're glad she's okay. And it wasn't worse than that. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. And this is hard work. It's the hours put in before dawn and after dark. It's the sacrifice, the sweat, the failure, and the faith. This is our industry. This is our life's work.
This week's news is sponsored by West Point Thoroughbreds. West Point 2-year-old sale graduates flexed their muscle over the weekend. Jackson Traveler, who came out of this year's OBS spring sale, improved to 3-for-3 and became a stakes winner in the Maryland Juvenile Futurity. And Chestertown, who was the sale topper at OBS March in 2019. He also won the Albany Stakes at Saratoga. He continued his progression under Steve Asmussen, had a 3-length allowance win at Aqueduct. So he's a pretty interesting 4-year-old. And there's some West Point news that relates to our friend John Green as well.
That's right. We're taking this to a personal level now, where for the first time in our 30-plus year history and West Point's 30-year history, we are actually merging forces. We are joining together to co-own a horse that we campaigned for the first two races of his career, SWAT Analysis. And that horse going forward will be campaigned by DJ Stable, Cassius King, Chuck Zackney, who was our original partner when the horse is staying in for a piece, and West Point Thoroughbred. And the horse will run, hopefully, in the Louisiana Futurity on New Year's Eve down at the fairgrounds.
Not too shabby. A son of Anchor Down, who's starting to come up as well. So shout out to West Point for buying in, and we wish you guys the best of luck.
Thank you. Hopefully we'll have more to talk about with that horse as he develops.
For sure. Might be another little no parole.
No parole. You might have to get another hat. We may have to get Bill a hat, a SWAT Analysis hat.
So a little bit of news on the timing front this week. I'm going to toss this to Bill because he has most of the details, but we talked about it before, the GMAX timing system, which is the GPS-based timing system that Equibase has instated at a lot of different tracks, continues to have problems. This was a story over the summer at Del Mar where they had to start hand timing all their turf races, and it sounds like the kinks really haven't been worked out yet. What did you learn, Bill?
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up. But going back, we wrote a story a couple months ago around the summer at Del Mar where this new timing system put into place by Equibase that uses GPS technology was causing a lot of problems. You have times that were clearly erroneous. You had races, like you said, where Del Mar had to go back and hand time them. There were races where the time would come up on the board 1:11, something like that. They would realize that was wrong. They would correct them in the charts. It might show up at 1:11 and 4, something like this. So at the time, Equibase put out a statement that says, look, we're going to fix it. Paraphrasing, we're going to fix this thing. Lo and behold, 3 months later, they simply haven't. You know, the same sort of things are happening at tracks all across the country where they have this system. So, you know, that's the backstory. And I didn't editorialize when I was writing this, but now I can. This thing doesn't work. I mean, it's that simple. You know, if it only had been around for a month or something and installed at one track, and we're talking about, you know, 100 races, you can say, okay, they need to get the work the kinks out, like you said, or give them time. This thing has been around for more than 2 years now. And, you know, it started right at the offset having problems when they were the timing at Laurel. It's still going on. I mean, the timing at Tampa Bay Downs, they would literally put up things like quarter mile went in 33 seconds. Wait a minute, no. So, you know, it looks like it's a lemon. And what do you do with a lemon? You get rid of it. Now, but that seems to be something that the Jockey Club / Equibase is not willing to do. And I can understand why. I'm sure they invest a lot of money in this and they want to get it right. But, you know, all this time passing, I have come to the conclusion, so have a lot of people, I think it's the only conclusion you can come to, is that this thing is just a flawed product. And, you know, we're going to talk a lot in the show as we go on with some of the things that we're going to bring up about, you know, racing, getting things right, or just doing the right thing. This is the exact opposite of it. You know, right now in the Olympics, you can time races to a millionth of a second. Horse racing in 2020 can't get the basic times right in its races. A matter of fact, they've gone backwards. In 1950, they were doing a better job than they're doing in 2020. So, I mean, hopefully it'll get fixed. I don't think it will. And if it doesn't, at some point, the Jockey Club just has to throw in the towel and say, hey, we tried. This thing is just not that good. Let's move on to something else.
So are we surprised the fact that they said it's going to take a little while to get fixed and even that timing was wrong?
Right, yeah.
That's all John has.
That's all I got. That's all I got for you. Sorry.
Decent line. We'll take that. But yeah, I mean, we've spoken about this before, but it seems like trying to reinvent the wheel, because the timing system that we have in racing with the teletimer, I don't remember anyone ever complaining that there were, you know, mass inaccuracies in that timing system. So I think it's just kind of new technology for technology's sake. And that's kind of the trend in the world right now, where you get just put a chip in everything and then you can't answer your doorbell because the Wi-Fi is down or whatever. So I think that this is one of those cases where it's just, oh, well, new technology automatically equals better. And that's not always the case. And it's just so fundamental to racing and to handicapping to get the times right. That, you know, even if they improve it to the point where they can get, I don't know, 95%, 98% of the times right, like, that's still not good enough, especially since you sold it as an improvement on what we already had. And that's definitely not the case, and only so far. And I think they're trying to kind of adapt what other sports are doing, because a lot of other sports are doing this GPS technology. But I think that makes more sense in other sports where the movements are so different. You know, when you have a basketball player or a football player and they're doing all these different movements and you want to track their movements and their conditioning and all that stuff, that I think makes more sense than just horses going around in an oval over and over again. I don't understand the need for GPS timing technology when it's just such a uniform movement. I think the beams being tripped by the leading horse makes the most sense. And I think that it's been done for decades without many problems. And I think eventually we're going to have to throw in the towel on GMAX and go back to that. It seems like that's the way this is going, that there are still these issues, what, 4 or 5 months later from when the story was first reported. And then there were probably months before that where it was an issue before it was reported. So, you know, they've had time to get this right. And you know, I don't want to dump on them too much, because I in general, I like the idea of bringing new technology to racing and trying to modernize it more. I think that in general is a good thrust and a good, attitude to have when you're the powers that be in racing. But I just think this is a scenario where it didn't work out. Eventually it'll be time to scrap it. And there's probably going to be a lot of wasted money that was spent in the meantime trying to get this thing adapted. And it hasn't worked out. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among high-class horses and stakes action and high-class people like John Green for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtv.com. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds. So this week we had some trainer beef. Can we get like a big banner that says trainer beef with like sirens and air horns and have the text shake? Because we love some beef on this show. Before we had jockey agent beef, now we got trainer beef. And it's two trainers at the top of the game as well. And you know, before we get into it, I really do think that this makes racing more interesting. Like, have some personality, talk some crap about somebody else, like, liven this thing up a little bit. You know, I'm a sucker for gossip. So basically the deal was, in the Cigar Mile, we mentioned before, Performer was a bad third in that race. And Shug McGahee talked to the Blood Horse and said that basically didn't blame the track specifically, but the implication was that the track was bad. And the reason he said that the track was bad is because it was so late in the year. He said the horses shouldn't be running in grade one races in December in New York. But, you know, honestly, they've been running it, the Cigar Mile, the first Saturday in December for a couple of years now. And even before that, it was Thanksgiving weekend. So it was only 1 week earlier. It wasn't that big of a difference. This has been a traditional spot on the calendar for the Cigar Mile. And, you know, the horse just didn't run well. And you could have had, you know, if he didn't like the track, you could have had that track a week earlier as well. It just so happened to be muddy and nasty for Saturday's races. And I understand the disappointment, especially with a horse like Performer, who took a long time to get back to the races after winning the Discovery, ironically around the same time last year at Aqueduct, took almost a year to come back to the races, ran it at Belmont once, and then disappointed in the Cigar Mile. So I get, like, putting all of your time into getting that horse back and then having him run so poorly because you think the track wasn't right, but just the calendar excuse, I think, is a ridiculous one. So Chad Brown opined on it on Twitter, and we still don't 100% know if this is the real Chad Brown, but it says the real Chad Brown in his handle. So we're going to go with it. So he had some words for Shug and what Shug said in the Blood Horse. He said, "So let me get this straight, Shug. The Naira writes you a 5-horse field layup allowance race on October 17th as prep for the Cigar. And because it rained on December 5th, it's Naira's fault. Your horse got beat. Give me a break. You have had Diamond Lane at Naira." So there was a lot of discussion about that on racing Twitter. Some people fell on Chad's side. Some people thought he was being a little classless. I mean, I think on the merits of it, he's right that it is that Shug's complaints are a little frivolous and ridiculous. But it's just interesting to see, you know, there had to be some animosity built up between those two for Chad to come out like this. I don't think this was just a reaction to what Shug said in the Blood Horse. He thought Shug was whining, so he's saying this. There has to be some kind of beef. And if you guys want to come on the show and settle it like gentlemen, we will have both of you, one of you, on the show to talk about it, because, you know, we had that thing with Ken McPeak and the Jackie's agent earlier in the year, and that was a fun little beef. As long as we keep it on wax, as long as we don't take it to the streets, it's all good in the racing world, as long as it's just words. But I just wonder if you guys had any thoughts on that, this little spiciness in racing for once.
Yeah, Joyce, you have a huge smile on your face right now. And why? I'm not going to take Shug's side or Chad Brown's side. I mean, I don't really care. But this is so unlike horse racing. I mean, trainers never do this. I mean, there's never any mudslinging. There's never any, you know, rocking the boat type of thing. And it's kind of fun. I mean, we're all going to move on from this. And you know, by this time next year, this will all be forgotten. But yeah, I mean, maybe, you know, maybe, John, you have an opinion on who's right and who's wrong. I don't really care. I just think it's a lot of fun. Give us more mudslinging, you know.
Yes.
It can bring a little bit of WWE into horse racing. And, you know, again, it's just kind of fun. And so, you know, should Chad have done it? Probably not, but who cares? It was a lot of fun.
Yep.
Yeah, I was a little surprised on a couple of levels. Number one, that Shug, you know, in an interview talked about, you know, how bad the track was, he was kind of all over the place. He was blaming everyone except for his own horse, you know, for not, you know, and the horse ran third. I mean, it wasn't like the horse ran up the racetrack and obviously didn't like the slop, nor was it like that the horse, you know, hadn't run and won on an off track before. The race before in this, you know, layup allowance race that they set up for him, the horse, you know, went a one turn mile and won rather easily in the mud. Now, granted, consistencies of racetracks change as the weather changes. I understand that. That was back in October, and now it's 6 weeks later. You know, so and one was at Belmont, one was in New York, and one was at Aqueduct. So I get it. I mean, I understand that there are minor differences. But when I first read the comments, I was saying to myself, all right,
in the heat of the moment, Chug was very upset that his horse that we even talked about, you know, pre-race, that we thought, hey, if Performer runs well, he's a horse in 2021 that we're going to be really excited to watch in the handicap division, because, you know, horses in the handicap division overall are dropping like flies from retiring. So he could be like an up and coming horse that we were all very genuinely excited about. And he put in a clinker. And maybe that was why Chug, you know, went in the interview and said, ah, this horse, you know, because he was frustrated about the way the horse ran. And, you know, he didn't want to point the finger at the horse itself, saying either the horse didn't compete, or point it back at himself and say, I didn't do a good job getting this horse ready for this race, and now I'm embarrassed. Was it heat of the moment? Probably. But the other surprise was that allegedly, we think it is, was Chad that came in. And Chad did not have a horse in the race, didn't have a dog in the fight. I mean, it wasn't like, hey, Chad's horse won and Chug threw mud on it because he was like, you know, this race sucked because, you know, it was so late in the year and it never should have been blah, 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 you know. And Chad took offense to that because his horse, Chad didn't even have an entry in the race. I mean, so it wasn't even like, hey, don't besmirch my horse, you know, for beating you. He just kind of piled on and basically said, hey, old man, and I'm paraphrasing, hey, old man, you've had it very good in Naira for a number of years. Now is not the time to shoot at Naira and say that it was their fault, because you've been on the gravy train, the diamond lane, as I think exactly what he said, for decades and decades. And it's really not cool that you know, your horse didn't run any good. And instead of saying, hey, you know, it was a bad day, it was an off day, you immediately started to attack Naira. And that's not the right thing. So, you know, to me, it was a very interesting kind of out of the blue for both of them, out of the norm for both of them, personality wise, to come out, and one for Chug to make excuses for everything else except for his own training and his own horse. And for Chad to come in basically from the sideline and say, don't bite the hand that fed you, and just accept the fact that, you know, horses are horses, as we say all the time, they're not machines. So your horse didn't compete that day to the best of what everyone's expectations were. You got to take the third and regroup and hope that he does, you know, runs better in 2021, which really could happen. I mean, the horse is still a phenomenal athlete. And basically I still am rooting for him in 2021.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody's throwing in the towel on Performer still not having a good 5-year-old season. He does have to stay on the racetrack. That's been a problem for him is keeping that horse together. But, you know, he obviously has a bunch of talent, and we're not going to throw him out because of that race. But I just love it. I love the honesty. Like, that's, you know, even in Shug's case, even if, like, we lean towards thinking that Chug was wrong here and criticizing Naira and criticizing the track, you know, I at least appreciate the honesty here. And same with Chad. You know, a lot of people, some people said that it wasn't a good look for Chad being at the top of the game, you know, to throw water on Chug, but it's not like Chug is some little 5% trainer that he's picking on. Like, Chug McGahee is a Hall of Famer. He can take his lumps like a man. And we like both of them. We've had both of them on the show. They were both good interviews, both obviously incredibly intelligent and you know, skilled horsemen. So it's not about them or their training or anything. We just like the drama. Give us more drama. Like, hit me up on Twitter, email me, do something. You got some kind of beef with somebody in this industry, I'm all ears. Call the hotline. We'll put you on and let you air your grievances against somebody else in this industry, because this is the conflict sells. And, you know, it's just such a boring, tight-lipped industry overall that we appreciate these little morsels of honesty that we get. And there's no harm, no foul. You know, they might give each other some dirty looks on the back stretch, you know, when they see each other now, but they're Chad and Sugar aren't going to fight. There's not going to be a Royal Rumble battle between them. It's all good. And we just like a little bit of the spiciness.
It's kind of like, Joe, when people were complaining about your plant earring, and now you doubled down and made it a lit plant earring.
I have two plants now.
Exactly. Very nice. Very, very nice. Yep. So keep the dirt a coming. If you want to say that, that Bill is ugly, you know, send it, have at it.
No, we're not soliciting disses on us.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
No, we're too sensitive for that.
We're journalists. We're sensitive, right?
We just want to sit there and watch people fight. I think that's what everybody wants to do.
Now I understand the rules of the game. Thank you, sir.
The New York Racetrack Chaplaincy's Christmas Drive is underway. The Racetrack Chaplaincy does great work all across the country, but especially in New York, helping out the backstretch communities of Belmont, Saratoga, and Aqueduct. Learn about why it's such a worthwhile mission and why you should consider sponsoring a family this Christmas.
In my time around the backstretch, it's been apparent to me that the backstretch chaplaincy is really part of the backbone of the racetrack and what they do for people, the care. There are no bounds, no limits to what they will do for the people of the backstretch in terms of improving the quality of life. And I fully intend to support their Christmas charity and their pledge and to support a family.
All right, so we're bringing on a very special fourth panelist at the moment. This is our fearless leader, our publisher at the TDN, Sue Finley, who wrote a story in yesterday's TDN that's getting a lot of traction on our website right now. It's the number two trending story already. It's called Horse Racing Wants New Blood or Does It? And it's about a personal experience that she has with someone who is being shut out of racing pretty unjustifiably. I'll let Sue explain the rest.
Hey, Joe, thanks so much. I heard you wanted a good beef this week, so I'm trying to, you know, provide you with as many as I can.
More scandal.
Yeah. So it's an interesting story to me because it's a small personal story at its root, right? It's about a friend of mine who will not be allowed to take the test as a jockey's agent, even though he's more than qualified to be one. And the reason he's not allowed to take the test is because of some arcane rule that was put into place in 1984 by the New York State Gaming Commission that says, in order to become a jockey's agent, you need to have been a trainer, jockey, or exercise rider for at least a year, unless you come in with a jockey from another jurisdiction. So Drew Mollica, for example, had Chris Antley for 2 years in Maryland. He was allowed to come to New York, and they're not going to say, sorry, you've got to go work on the backstretch for a year before you do that. And so Farron Peterson, you know, Julie Crone, I don't know if anybody knows this, went back to California a couple of weeks ago. She was here as Farron's agent for the summer, and it was very hard being that far away from her daughter. She has a 15-year-old daughter in an era of COVID when you can't travel back and forth anymore. You know, she sort of took the job with the expectation that she'd see more of her, et cetera, and decided it just wasn't working. So Farron's looking for an agent, tried a bunch of the usual suspects, couldn't find someone. And I said, hey, I have this idea. And, you know, come to find out, we went in to take the test and was told, we're not even going to give you the test, which to me just seems ludicrous.
Yeah. And so, I mean, what exactly is the law? What reasoning did they give him for not letting him take the test?
They said, you've never been a jockey, a trainer, or an exercise rider. And the stipulations are you have to be 18 and you have to have performed one of those three jobs or you're not allowed to be a jockey's agent. And, you know, it just so happens this kid, he's 23. He's graduated from business school at Stevens. He's getting his MBA. He's been a racehorse owner for 2 years. And, you know, he's somebody I've known my whole life. And it just so happened that he reached out to me this summer and said, I have this horse I'm looking to retire. His name is Blue Pigeon. He's 9. He's still able to race, but he's earned a good retirement. What do you think I should do? And like, I was so impressed by that because his trainer was saying, no, this horse could still race for you. And he's saying, well, he's old. I'm worried about him. I want him to have a good career. So, you know, he spent $2,500 to retire this horse. And I just thought like, wow, that's the sort of person we need more of in horse racing, right? Someone who's smart, who's educated, who's going to do the right thing. And without even looking at any of those credentials, the state steward said, like, go away. I don't even want to talk to you. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's emblematic of the attitude of you know, racing decision makers in a lot of cases about how, you know, in terms of how hard it is for new people to break in. I wish we had Brian on because he talks sometimes about how difficult it is to get owners registered in different states. And just how they protect those owners' licenses. And it seems they protect other jobs as well. And it's not nepotism necessarily because it's not necessarily families, you know, decreeing jobs to other families, but it's kind of a nepotistic society in racing where it's like, you're part of this clique, you're part of this crew. these are the applicants. This is the pool of applicants that we can go to. And it just, it discourages people from getting into the game. And he seems like the kind of, like you said, the kind of guy that we want in the game for sure. He's a young guy. He would be in it for decades. It's an arcane rule, and it's unfortunate. I was wondering if Bill or John, if you guys had anything to add about this, about maybe experiences about how, you know, how hard it is for new people to get in the game.
Well, I don't want to talk about my personal experience or anything like that, but I have a follow-up question on this. I mean, we all admit this is just an idiotic rule. There's no other way to put it. It doesn't make any sense. But what seems to be even worse is they don't seem to there seems to be a hypocrisy here. You look at the people who are jockey agents, and there's dozens that don't qualify under this rule. People who have come into to be jockey agents from other sports or have come into racing and have not been the exercise rider, jockey, et cetera. Why do you think they applied it to some people and not to others? And they take this one guy, 23 years old, and say, you can't be a jockey agent. But maybe 9 months ago, they looked the other way.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. And I can't answer that. I suspect that you're right. I suspect if you comb through everybody's resumes who is a jockey's agent right now, you would find that it's not being applied across the board. I think that they have probably made exceptions for people. To me, it wasn't about the other jockey's agents and whether or not they're doing something wrong. To me, this story just struck a nerve in me, and I think it strikes a nerve in other people because we're all asked all the time to join these committees, to find new fans, to find new people, new blood. You know, you look at the money that, say, Godolphin spends on the Flying Star program to bring new people in. There's a group announced every week, Amplify, to bring new fans and new people into racing. Last week, it was Together for Racing International. And then when someone comes along and says, I want to get into racing, our answer is, sorry, you can't get into racing because you're not already in racing. It doesn't make any sense. And I think for me, it was, it's kind of a personal thing because, and Bill, I feel like your story is the same, by the way. This is how we came into racing. Our parents brought us to the track. Joe, John, I feel like you're the same way. We went to the track as young people. We learned how to handicap. We fell in love with it. We learned everything we could. We went to college. And then we went out to the track and we got a job. At NYRA, I was hired while I was still in college at 21. Within a year, I was making the morning line. Nobody ever said to me, but can you gallop a horse? And, 35 years later, like you said about Philip, I'm still in the sport because there wasn't some stupid rule like this about the job I happened to take.
And the thing that's crazy about this, Sue, is that basically under the current conditions of that rule, I'll take myself as an example. I've been in the business 35 years. Okay. I've done basically every part of the industry, from breeding to racing to managing, everything in between. I'm eligible to be placed on the NYTHA board, but I would be ineligible to be a jockey agent, as would Martin Panza, as would, a lot of people who are in racing right now. But ironically enough, Jorge Navarro would still be eligible because he hasn't been convicted of anything yet. So that's how backwards this rule is that, guys like that who are under federal investigation may still be eligible, but the rest of us wouldn't be. And I went through other, when I read your article, which is very thought provoking, I went through and said, okay, what about other industries? What do they do? Sports agents. Well, they don't have to be a professional athlete, a coach, or even a trainer, in order to be eligible. Most of them are attorneys. A talent agent, same thing. You don't have to be an actor on Broadway or the silver screen. Real estate agents, you don't have to be a builder or even a landlord to be eligible to take the test. And we're not even assuming that the kid would pass the test, although I think he would, okay? But just to be outwardly, shunned and say, not only can't you take this test, but you have to do one of these other jobs, which really, and for all intents and purposes, don't have anything to do with being a jockey agent.
I mean, nothing.
It's an apprenticeship. Like, if you want to be a jockey, you get to be an apprentice jockey. I understand that. You have to learn. There's a lot to learn, being on the back of a horse. Okay. But in this case, and I'm not taking anything away from jockey agents, but there's no rationale behind having to know, how to clean a horse's hoof and whether or not, Farron would be, the right mount, would have the right mount in the fifth race 5 days from now.
Right. It's a job that requires some mathematical skills, an understanding of horse racing and good people skills. That's it. And that's, you know, again, like I said in the article, nothing wrong with coming from the backstretch, but is that really the only way to get here? That's the part that makes no sense. You could, you know, gallop horses for a year and become a jockey agent, but you can't grow up around racing, go to business school and become a jockey agent. And I guess the thing that frustrates me about the whole thing is that of all the people to whose attention I brought this, nobody said anything other than, well, yeah, that's the rule. You know, like there's, and this again speaks to the larger picture of why we often get frustrated with horse racing. There wasn't anyone who said, well, let's look to change that. That's ridiculous. Like, we have to do away with that. It was all like, well, you know, yeah, that's where the rule is. And so the sort of lack of critical thinking is frustrating for those of us who've made our whole lives in the sport and who need the sport to succeed in order for us to continue doing so.
I heard the real reason why he couldn't sit for the test was Shug said that the racetrack was off.
Might have been.
Oh, John, I always got to slip in a one-liner. But no, I mean, that's right. And you mentioned the groups that pop up to try to, you know, advertise racing to young people. And I think that's good. I think those are good initiatives, but I don't think more hashtags are going to get the job done. I think there's going to have to be a lot of rule changes that the current rules aren't common sense. I think that's a big undertaking, but I think that's going to have more of an effect in terms of getting new people and especially younger people into the game.
Right. Let's just all use a little more common sense, I guess. And incidentally, you know, Farron still doesn't have an agent because, you know, she sort of spent 2 weeks thinking, well, this guy's great. Surely they'll approve him. And so now, you know, it's affected her life and our life in racing more than it's going to affect Philip's life. Because like I said, he'll go on and do something, you know, much more important. But that's the shame of it.
All right. So thanks so much for coming on, Sue, and for the story. Obviously, really thought provoking. It's on the TDN website right now. It's in the trending section. If you want to go check it out, Sue also tweeted it out. And there's a pretty good conversation in the comments as well, if you want to get involved in that. So thanks for coming on and explaining it to us, Sue.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, great job, Sue. Thank you.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So our Green Group Guest of the Week this week is the COO of First Racing and the president of First Content, longtime bigwig at the Stronic Group, Aiden Butler. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, guys. Good to see you, brother.
Glad to have you. So we're going to talk about Gulfstream. You're overseeing Gulfstream in Maryland right now, and I think you guys are doing some good things there.
Well, I'm actually at Santa Anita right now, but yeah, I should be at work at Gulfstream.
Right. Yeah. But you're still home. Santa Anita, I think you've called home for a couple of years now. And I wanted to ask you about your time at Santa Anita, because it's obviously been a very eventful few years to say the least. There's been a lot of pressure from the government, from PETA, from horsemen, with the breakdown issues that you guys had, and then some of the COVID issues and wildfires. You really have had to deal with everything the last couple of years at Santa Anita. So I just kind of wanted to know what that's like, what it's been like to try to operate, balancing out all of those different interests that are in your ear.
Well, it's not a good idea. If you wanted to find a job that doesn't send you gray quickly and stress you out, this isn't the one. But I think just it's difficult to sum up quickly, but I think Santa Anita is such a special place. I mean, we're horse racing people, so we get it, but it's such a special place that kind of the more difficult things became, the more everybody here at the track turned and fought, you know, and made sure we did things better, made sure that we could continue to operate and not be, you know, not just stand there and have people who don't love the sport, don't care about the sport, try and dictate what we do. So, in short, I think if it less a business, less a place. I don't know how much people would have fought, but this place it seemed to be easy. We all pulled together pretty quickly from what was not a particularly brilliant relationship a few years ago to we all kind of stand shoulder to shoulder out here. Well, for the most part, I'd be lying if I said people didn't complain about stuff, but for the most big things, we're all together.
Hey, and it's Bill Finley, and thanks for joining us. I think right now, if we had a poll who's the most popular man in horse racing, you might actually win because of what you did at Santa Anita. And I would ask you to, people know the story as the dreaded drag. The race is going off 7-8 minutes after the listed post time that you've done away with. Two-part question. If you could just, again, rehash the reasons why you did it. And somewhat more importantly, I know we're only 4 or 5 days into the meet, but we had a record handle for the claim of the crown. You know, if you, as you crunch the numbers, how is this thing working out? Because I think there was some fear that people would not adjust, they would get shut out, and it would negatively impact the handle.
Thank. Well, I think it's a fairly low bar being the most popular guy in horse racing, so I'll take it as a compliment regardless. But so when we thought about the drag and you know, just the impact it had, we all understand that, you know, on certain days, on certain races, on certain betting events, you know, pick six mandatory payouts, you know, big days, having a drag to give more people time to put stuff in is a good thing. It definitely helps the handle. But having spoken to, not just myself, but a lot of people who have really studied this, when it becomes the norm, it removes any upside or positivity. And in the end, I felt all it was doing is making us not look you know, professional. How can you be a big racetrack like Gulfstream Park that tries to, and in my estimation, could be as good as any track in the world? And you know, you can't get the fundamentals of like running on time down. And I think it just made, to me, just in my head, it made a little bit of a mockery of things. And I know that maybe I'm not as wise as some people, but I kind of know the parts that make the game tick, right? I understand the bettors. I come from a gambling background when I was a bookie, so I understand the customer service aspect of that and trying to keep the bettors as interested. Now more than ever, there's, you know, there's other stuff they can bet on now. There's other states doing different, you know, different things with sports wagering. So now's the time to really shine and put our best foot forward as a wagering medium. And I just felt that the drag had passed itself by day, put it that way.
Aiden, one of the things that we've seen over the past, you know, few decades is that the StroNet group overall, they're not afraid to innovate and try new things. I mean, I remember, you know, 20 years ago, even when Andy was trying to do the East-West jockey competitions and everything in between. So what innovative, you know, things are we going to see from you that you're going to be unveiling over the next few months?
So really good question. And I think there's a thing, right? There's a couple of things. Innovation for innovation's sake, but then there's also those who feel that the world should never change. And I kind of commend even people who came before me, not just the StroNet group, who tried stuff, because you don't know if it's going to be good until you try, and sometimes, and most of the time, fail. And I think our industry is not one for letting you off the hook should you have a bad idea that you get reminded of it constantly. But I think the first things first, just to simplify, I think we've got to run a better product all across the industry, right? We've got to run a cleaner product. We've got to run a more transparent product. I think, you know, as far as, you know, paying attention to the constituents, you know, to the ecosystem. So that's the players, that's the horsemen, the owners. You know, they don't have to spend their money buying horses. I know it feels like it's kind of an addiction, and I'm like kind of a hoarder of ponies. I keep adopting ponies left, right, center. So I understand the fascination with horses and the love for them, but you know, there's not an abundance of new owners coming into the sport. So anything we can do to innovate around the owners, and that can be on track experience, it can be, you know, just the way they are thought of and treated, I think is first and foremost. And then just look at how the kind of the economic engine works here. It's financial and it's driven by wagering. Offer the Wager is a great project to bet on. We've got, you know, I don't want to kind of spoil it, but I think there's some efficiencies we can do with, you know, from a technology standpoint to really, make ourselves competitive with other sports. And I think that's where I'm going to try and spend a lot of my time. But you'll see a few things coming down the pipe. Everything's that title of being popular is going to wane a little bit because I've got a few things to do that maybe not so popular. But I think we've got a shot. We've really got a shot here.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the Santa Anita issues that you've had to deal with, especially the equine safety issues. I think Santa Anita has done a great job. Del Mar has done a great job. California Racing, I think, in general, has done a very good job turning that around. I wonder if there's anything that you learned from that experience about keeping horses safer that you might, you know, impart at Gulfstream or Maryland. What did you learn about what's effective in terms of improving the safety of the racehorses?
Right. I mean, I learned a hell of a lot. What I knew about, you know, the veterinary side of the business was slim to none. And we've got some great veterinarians led up by Dr. Dion Benson, our chief veterinary officer. But the one thing I learned is that you can't do it on your own. You can be as tough as you want to be and try and mandate rules. But unless you can get buy-in from the horsemen, and not all horsemen, and just to touch on the point before about innovation for innovation's sake or people who don't want the world to change, you have to kind of do it in unison and in a kind of a partnership with the horsemen. But the difference in California is we had a lens on us, and there was nobody, man, woman, or child, who didn't understand the seriousness and the ramifications of what was going on. Other states, I don't think it's a good thing, but maybe not quite as sensitive to things that can happen. So it's a tough one, but I think Santa Anita can be a test case and can be a just a story of what can go wrong and what can happen if people take their eye off the ball a little bit. So I'm kind of optimistic that the Santa Anita lessons can be taught. And I've got a great relationship with the horsemen in Florida and a really good relationship coming with the horsemen in Maryland. So they understand we're not doing it just to add rules and innovation. This is for the greater good of all of us. And I think for us to be taken really seriously, these are the sorts of things we have to look at. We have to look at medication reform. Not just for the health and safety of the animals. It's for the integrity of what we do, right? We all like a wager, and I think somebody in my job probably should wager a little bit, because it kind of shows you what you what it's all about. But you've got to be offer a really good, clean product, and that starts with the safety of not only the horse but the rider.
Hey, let's take you to Maryland for a second, and it's been several months since a bill was passed, which was, on the surface, very good news for Maryland racing. Money was going to be spent by the Maryland Stadium Authority to completely rebuild Pimlico and to do a major rebuild at Laurel as well. But since that time, we've heard almost nothing about, what the future of Pimlico is, when things might happen so far as rebuilding the track. So just bring us up to speed on the latest on it.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's super exciting, the thought of it, right? I mean, when was the last time one racetrack was rebuilt, let alone two? Maryland's a very proud state. I think of it more like home, just the way the horsemen are, the way people think of things. It's an older state, so there's a lot of history there with regards to the racing. But I think some of the negativity of COVID has trickled everywhere, right? A lot of plans, a lot of things that need big groups, big meetings, lots of conversation about, what a new track would look like, how a new track would function have been delayed slightly. So it's not from lack of enthusiasm that things have maybe slowed down a little bit, but I think it's just the state of the world at the moment. It's a lot of money that needs to be allocated and spent, and at the moment there's a lot of money needed everywhere, so I think people are just being very cautious. But I hope you'll hear some stuff. I'll give you the shout early in the new year once I've got my feet under me and spent more time in Maryland.
Aiden, one of the trainers that we interviewed a few months ago, we asked him, what's a good day for you? And he said, a good day for me is when I pull up to my barn and my assistant trainer isn't walking the shed row, nervously waiting for me to come in. What's a picture perfect day for Aiden Butler when he comes to work?
Well, that's a really, really good question. I guess a picture perfect day for me is a race day. It's a day where I, especially in my new job, I find out if there's any issues across the track. So I not only look after kind of the East Coast, I'm obviously the COO for all the tracks. So any issue at any track, I get to hear about, which when you got a lot of tracks, that's a hell of a lot of issues. So perfect day for me would be up bright and early, get out training, whichever track I'm at, everything goes well. Everybody has a safe return. It doesn't get any easier than that for me. I guess I've become slightly obsessed now with welfare of the animal and the rider, just people getting around safe. It's a lot of responsibility. And sometimes, I don't know, you don't necessarily sign up for the responsibility you're given. And I'm not sure I did, but I've got it. So I take it really seriously. And, it means probably I wear stuff on my sleeve a little more than I should. But for the most part, I as long as everybody's back safe, I get to see some good racing. I've got the best job in the world. On the opposite side to that, I can have a pretty crappy job sometimes. But sometimes it's a high risk, high reward, put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to ask about your background a little bit too. I detect an accent, I think.
A little one, Long Island, New York.
And then you mentioned that you were a bookie before, so that's pretty interesting. So can you expound on that and maybe give us the Cliff version of how you got from there to here?
Yeah, certainly. So my grandfather was a licensed bookie. Well, my grandfather was a bookie in England before they were licensed. We're from a town called Birmingham, which you might know from Peaky Blinders. From that place, grandfather was a bookie, father was a bookie, uncle was a bookie. I became a licensed bookie at 21, which made me one of the youngest in the country. Now, it's different in England. We're racecourse bookies, so I actually traveled 39 different racetracks, averaged 3 or 4 days a week racing, which was fun. And did that for years. Things changed over there when the internet came around, and people were less likely to go to the races, and you guys, I'm sure, follow. It's tough over there at the moment from a gambling perspective and from a horseman's perspective. But, I was born into it. Few career changes. I worked in law. I was then the managing director of a litigation shop for a while, and then decided I was better off doing my own thing. So had a series of different startups, some really good, some not so good. But I found my way back into this industry. I've known the Stronach family, Belinda particularly, for a long, long time. And we were having a conversation one day. I went to Preakness just as a fan. And it kind of went from there. That was probably 3 years ago now. So things happen fast. But it's kind of in your blood, as you guys are aware. I mean, at this point, kind of not sure what else I would do.
And let's go, as we hop around the country, let's go back to Florida. And a couple weeks ago, I saw the closing of Calder/Gulfstream Park West. It's a sad occasion for a lot of people in Florida, basically. Yeah. But it definitely has an impact on Gulfstream because Calder served a purpose. It gave Gulfstream that 2-month break, especially give the track a chance to refurbish the turf course for the championship. I mean, I think also just the psychological effects of, letting their hair down for a couple weeks, couple months, et cetera.
Yeah.
How is Gulfstream going to tackle this problem going forward? Is it going to be a 365-day-a-year racetrack? And what are the ways that you're going to compensate for the loss?
Well, first of all, I really agree. And I'm a kind of a newbie to American racing, but it sticks in my throat when we lose another track, right? Because it just seems to be relentless. And I'm going to get into what my feelings are on why it keeps happening and how certain organizations should probably do better to try and sustain racing. But with Calder, the smart approach, and I think this has been whispered around, but the smart approach would be to put in a synthetic track at Gulfstream Park and have three surfaces. The issue, as we're all aware, it's such an amazing large turf course there, but using it that much, it does get cut up. And should the weather change, which it often does, I'm learning that it often does in Florida quickly, it decimates the card. These cards get blown apart. And there's now so many scratches that the racing becomes mediocre. So I think, and I'm in discussions with Billy Mike, it was actually Billy and Mike's idea that if we could get a tapeta track or a synthetic track in there as part of the turf course, you now have the perfect three surfaces. It does rest up the turf a little bit. And should the weather change, it gives you a lot of options to keep turf races together. Also, from kind of a safety standpoint, it's a big, big track, and it's nice to have more than one training surface for the mornings. So that would be a really smart way of broaching the need for Calder, because as much as it being a break, another turf course was fundamentally important to us using Calder, because it gave the turf at Gulfstream Park a rest.
Aiden, one last question for me. One of the things that we've seen the past couple of years has been the inflow of European bloodlines. A lot of fillies coming in, especially from the leadership of Chad Brown. Obviously has won a ton of races on the turf for his clients, Klarovich and Peter Brandt and so on. Are there certain sire lines that you've seen in Europe that you feel like would do better here in the States? I know they just brought over Caravaggio and a couple other
things. Yeah, really good question. And I love the question, because I spent early on a bunch of time speaking to people trying to get European lines over here, because I thought that, just the basics, the purse money alone warrants, I'm not talking the best champions, because in England we still have owners that can prop up. They're not worried about purse money, right? They can prop up, acquisition of stock club more than anybody. I mean, they've got some of the wealthiest people in the world out there. But there's this middle ground of kind of a product, right, that can come over and really be competitive. So I think, you know, we've found ourselves in a position now where hopefully we don't decimate the European lines too much and we don't start bringing over too many, because I am British after all. And I know there's been some negativity online from some of the bigger trainers out there, particularly talking about the decimation of British lines and the decimation of stock, basically, that this, you know, the good horses being brought out here. But I think there's a happy medium here. And for me, I've got this weird and wonderful kind of idea, and I had this chat with a couple of trainers. There's one-way traffic. There's a lot of European horses coming over, and there's a lot of really good people. There's a few people on the West Coast who specialize in bringing Irish and English horses out here. But there's also a level of decent flat horses out here that could potentially go back and perform as hurdlers. You know, we have no distance racing out here, for instance, at all. And there's a bunch of lines that just happen to be better at distance. So I think there's, you know, maybe send the van this way with some of theirs and we'll send some of them back to be good hurdlers. So that's maybe a little optimistic, but I think as the world gets smaller from technology and just from logistical stuff, I think you're going to find the better lines ending up where they should be. And I also think, you know, as things change, you know, for instance, LASIKs and how that works with certain lines, I think you're going to see hopefully horses ending up where they should be.
Aiden, thank you so much.
You're the best, guys. Thanks for all your support through the year. I know it's been a bit of a topsy-turvy one, but we'll keep trying. And if you need me for anything, just give me a shout.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for the time.
I really appreciate it. Great job.
You're welcome, guys. Have a good, happy Christmas.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Aiden Butler will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust The Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over 4 decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit The Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. Remember, the Keeneland Digital Sale is December 15th. That's next Tuesday. You can find out more at keenelanddigital.com. And also the Keeneland January Catalog is available now at keeneland.com. 1,588 offerings, January 11th through 14th. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, Sue Finley, our Green Group Guest of the Week, Aiden Butler, our producer, Patty Wolf, our editors, Aliyah LaRocca and Danny Siper. Thank you so much for watching. Wear a mask. We'll see you next week for our last show of 2020.